You're with Breakfast on RN.
Good morning. This is AM. I'm Tony Eastley. In the United States, there are ominous signs that Hurricane Sandy is every bit as bad as authorities have warned. It's gaining strength and still heading towards one of the most heavily populated parts of America's East Coast. The massive storm, generating winds of up to 150 kilometres an hour, is about 180 kilometres southeast of Atlantic City in New Jersey and moving slowly towards heavily populated centres. Already its effects are being felt from North Carolina to Massachusetts, and there's been minor flooding in New York. With the high winds comes fears that there could be widespread power outages. Kim Landers reports.
Hurricane Sandy is still well offshore, but its strong winds and heavy rain are lashing the US East Coast. Some of America's biggest cities are ghost towns, and in New York, waves are splashing over the seawalls at the southern tip of Manhattan.
We didn't do anything last year for Irene, and it wasn't so bad, so we figured we'd brave it.
I was here last year for this. It wasn't as bad this early. Right now, it's you know over the bank already, so it could be, this is going to be a pretty bad storm. I'm building my staff already. I have all my extra guys in. And we're hoping that we're going to, you know, brave it out.
There's already flooding on Long Island, and some residents have swapped cars for inflatable boats.
I think just my family's leaving, the wife and kids are leaving. I got a couple of my friends going to stay with me tonight, and we're going to stick it out just to keep an eye on the house, make sure no houses burn down.
The president calls this a big and dangerous storm and warns it could be fatal.
Because of the nature of this storm, we are certain that this is going to be a slow-moving process through a wide swath of the country, and millions of people are going to be affected.
There have been dire warnings, too, from the governors of Connecticut and Maryland.
This is the most catastrophic event that we have faced.
There will be people who die and are killed in this storm.
And New York's governor, Andrew Cuomo, also has a somber message.
Do not underestimate this storm. These forecasts for the surge are really extraordinary.
Hurricane Sandy is expected to cross the coast somewhere between Washington and New York later today. The biggest danger in New York is a storm surge of up to 3.5 metres. Combined with a high tide, authorities say the waves could be up to 6 metres. In a city that never sleeps, New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg has this advice.
It may be a good time to just stay hunkered into your home and have a sandwich out of the fridge and sit back and watch television.
The effects of the massive storm are being felt along a 1,000-kilometre stretch of the coastline. In Rhode Island, people are still queuing at shops and petrol stations.
You can definitely tell there's a storm coming. I mean, everybody, it's crazy. It was mobbed, everybody in there. Crazy lines, like people out on the street waiting to pull in to get gasoline.
This massive storm is already having far-reaching consequences. 11,000 flights have been cancelled, and airlines say it could be days before schedules get back to normal. And for the first time since September the 11th, the New York Stock Exchange has been shut down. This is Kim Landers in Washington for AM.
And the ABC's Ben Knight is in the path of the massive storm in the Delaware town of Rehoboth Beach. He's at the high school there, which is doubling as a Red Cross emergency shelter, and he's on a Skype line. Ben, good morning. I hope you can hear me. How many people are there and what are they telling you?
Tony, there's about 150, more than 150 people who are here seeking shelter. There's around 20 other staff from the Red Cross and the National Guard and other agencies. And, well, what they're telling us is that they wish they knew what was going to happen. What we're seeing right now as I'm speaking to you is what I think is a taste of what's to come. It's been heavy rain and it's been strong wind, but right now it's really, really picking up. We're seeing trees bending over. I'm looking at horizontal rain. It was expected that it was going to reach us right about now. If this is it, then it's at least a foretaste of it. People here, they're quite calm at the moment, but they are expecting that it's going to be a pretty long, pretty noisy and unpleasant evening.
Ben, is everyone heeding the warning around that area of Delaware?
Well, of course, we won't know that until tomorrow. It appears that a lot of people are, and those who haven't really, well, they don't have much of an excuse. You can imagine what the coverage of this has been like over the past couple of days. And in fact, that's probably one of the saving graces, is that this has been slow moving. People have seen what it's done in the Caribbean, where more than 60 people were killed as this storm passed through. So there's been plenty of warning, plenty of time, plenty of preparation, which is why you have places like this. Where we are at the moment is, it's around about about a kilometre and a half from the beach, so it's therefore inside what's called a mandatory evacuation zone. People have been told they must get out. Now, if they stay, they won't be arrested, but what that means is that if they call the emergency services for help, as of now, then the emergency services will do what they can to get there, but if they can't, people are on their own. So what we're seeing is that a lot of people have taken the decision to come in early, although the National Guard are starting to bring in some people who they are managing to reach with their Humvees and their trucks.
Yep, and yes, you were going to introduce Steve Thomas to us.
Steve Thomas is one of the staff that's here. He's the guy that everybody keeps pestering because he's got a laptop and the only internet connection. He's the one who is watching what's going on.
Well, it's going to be bad. It's going to be a long night, unfortunately.
What are we expecting?
Strong winds. We're looking at, right now, they're at 90 miles an hour, and it should be about that when it makes landfall.
So that's the sustained winds. That's not even with the gusts.
Correct. Yep. That's as I understand it. And yeah, we're looking at torrential downpour all night.
90 miles an hour, it's around 150 kilometres an hour. Have you got any idea what that kind of wind means?
Nope, not a clue. All I know is that last night the gusts were about 40 miles an hour and the poles were moving and it looked bad. So twice that or more, who knows?
Jim Levan is one of the people who's come here to the shelter doing a jigsaw puzzle here, I suppose. Anything to pass the time?
Anything just to try to get your mind off of what's happening.
What do you think is going to happen?
I'm hoping nothing, but I'm fearing that we're going to get flooded out pretty bad.
Where's your house?
White House Beach in Long Neck.
Kim, you took some convincing to leave the house. You think you made the right call?
Yeah, I do now. Because I'm seeing the way the weather was, and I'm seeing that, you know, pictures that are coming in, and our road's totally flooded. We would never have been able to get out if we would have waited. This is, like, supposedly the perfect storm.
Kim Levan from White House Beach, Long Neck, Delaware, speaking there with the ABC's Ben Knight. The storm has upset the US presidential race, and while Mitt Romney has staked out hardline positions during the primary fight in a bid to convince the right wing of his party that he was conservative enough, he now finds himself presenting a far more moderate incarnation of himself in order to woo independent voters. North America correspondent Jane Cowan gauged how effective the Romney strategy has been in the swing state of Florida.
Honey, there's a strike.
On a weekday afternoon in Lake City in northern Florida, Dale DeVinney has the lanes to himself at the local bowling alley. He and his wife have heard talk of Mitt Romney's shift to the middle, but it doesn't worry him.
Well, I don't know about shifting. He's trying to be the people's man, which when he was in Massachusetts, Massachusetts is a Democratic state. Being a Republican governor in a Democratic state is very hard, but he got a lot done.
After describing himself as severely conservative to win the Republican nomination, Mitt Romney has, in the general election, moderated his stances on everything from foreign affairs and tax cuts to abortion in an effort to broaden his appeal to independent and undecided voters. The Obama campaign has leapt on the change, saying the Republican has forgotten what he stands for.
If you say earlier in the year, I'm going to give a tax cut to the top 1%, and then in a debate you say, I don't know anything about giving tax cuts to rich folks. You need to get a thermometer and take your temperature because you probably got Romneysia.
There are signs, though, the Republicans' pivot might be working. In Florida, AM encountered swing voters who supported Barack Obama last time, but who've been convinced by Mitt Romney, like this man who describes himself as a fiscal conservative but a social moderate.
I think I'll be supporting Romney. I did vote for Obama on the first term. I think both men are very well-intentioned. I guess my primary area of concern is the level of spending and the level of debt.
Tough economic times are dominating the dynamic, overriding concerns voters might otherwise have about the Republicans' positions on social issues.
Romney has more experience, obviously, running businesses, and to me, we need to start running this country more like a business.
Jason Roberts is a political scientist at the University of North Carolina and says it's common for candidates to tack back to the middle in a general election, but it's not without risk.
The big risk he would face then is if conservative voters on the right decided perhaps not to vote. I think what they're counting on, though, is that most of those people really do want to see the president defeated, and they're willing to sort of hold their nose, if you will, and vote for someone who is moderate if it means that they could have the president turned out of office.
Some Republicans, though, are troubled by a shape-shifting Romney campaign.
You just don't know, as a president, which Romney would take the presidency.
But he still plans to vote for the Republican. This is Jane Cowan in Florida for AM.
And you're listening to AM around Australia, where it's 20 minutes past 7. The federal opposition says the government is slowly but surely walking away from its promise to deliver a surplus this financial year. Last week's financial update forecast a smaller surplus than projected in the May budget. Questioned about guaranteeing that surplus, the Prime Minister yesterday referred to the government's plan and determination for a budget surplus. Shadow Treasurer Joe Hockey claims the government is preparing the ground to ditch its key commitment. He's speaking here to Alexandra Kirk in Canberra.
Well, clearly the Prime Minister is now walking away from her solemn commitment to deliver a budget surplus, which in turn would start to pay down Labor's debt. And quite clearly, the Prime Minister is typically using weasel words to avoid honouring a commitment that the Treasurer made just last Monday when he said, "We will deliver a surplus of around $1 billion this year."
But it's only a mini budget plan or forecast. That's all it is. Aren't you reading too much into it? Because the Prime Minister's taking it very literally.
Oh, well, it's a forecast of what they're planning to spend money on.
Correct. But so even then, a plan or a forecast?
Well, the Prime Minister announced $1.7 billion for the Murray-Darling Basin. Not a single dollar of that was contained in a statement just made a few days earlier. It's actually a budget statement. That means you're actually planning how you're going to spend money over the next, in this case, 8 months, and where that is going to leave your total budget number at the end of that 8 months of the financial year.
Now, considering the state of commodity prices, particularly resources prices, you wouldn't quibble with the Resources Minister Martin Ferguson's observation that you can't predict where they'll go. So the budget could slip into the red. The government's just stating the bleeding obvious, isn't it?
Well, you can and you do predict where you think commodity prices are going to go. The problem is that the Labor Party in government is spending money that it's not sure it's going to get. And now we know that the mining tax is going to raise hardly a dollar.
So do you maintain that the government won't deliver a surplus this year?
Well, the government's not going to deliver an honest surplus. We know they'll fiddle with the numbers. They've done it before. They'll do it again. They're watering down their words from "we will deliver a surplus" to "we promise to deliver a surplus." Now we have a plan and a determination.
Except that you don't believe that they won't.
No, I don't believe the Labor Party has it in their DNA to live within their means. So I suspect that they won't deliver a surplus. I suspect that it's all, you know, smoke and mirrors. And they're borrowing money to pay for today's promises to get them through a political fix.
Is it never okay for the budget to be in deficit?
If you're not getting a budget back to surplus when you have trend growth of 3 to 3.5% on their projections, which I think is a little generous, but that's their call. And when you've got still the best terms of trade in 100 years, if you're not doing it then, when do you do it?
The Shadow Treasurer, Joe Hockey, speaking to Alexandra Kirk. Melbourne researchers have developed a world-first model which will help better predict a woman's risk of contracting breast cancer. The scientists from the Peter MacCallum Cancer Centre have built on years of genetic research to refine a range of genetic risk factors into just one model. It's intended for use among women with a strong family history of the disease, but could ultimately one day be applied to all women. Rachel Carbonell reports.
Much of what is known about what causes breast cancer in women with a family history of the disease has come down to mutations in two now well-known breast cancer genes. But Associate Professor Paul James from the Peter MacCallum Familial Cancer Centre says mutations to those genes only account for about 20% of cases.
And so the question has been always, well, what can we use for the 80% of people where they have a strong family history, a high risk in the family, but those genes don't account for it?
The model builds on years of research which has identified many less significant breast cancer genetic risk factors and brings them together into one model, which can give a more detailed analysis of women's predisposition to the disease.
So all of us have a lot of variation in our genes, and some of those variations increase or decrease the risk for a condition like breast cancer a little bit. And what we've created is a model which integrates a lot of that information together and then is able to provide a detailed, personalised risk for a person, which ranges not just from high risk to normal risk, but has a whole lot of grades of risk in between.
It's about identifying a combination of normal genetic variations that perhaps add up to a certain risk factor for breast cancer.
That's right, yeah. That's exactly right. There's no longer one simple thing. I can't point to a BRCA1 gene and say, well, that's the problem. It's now a whole bunch of small effects being combined together into a model to tell us about risk. But the important thing about it is that this explains a significant amount of the breast cancer risk that wasn't explained before. And these are variants that help us understand the breast cancer risk for all high-risk women and probably eventually for all women in the population.
Associate Professor James says this means that women can then make choices about what actions or interventions they might take to deal with their risk of breast cancer. Gerda Evans was diagnosed with breast cancer when she was 40. Her three sisters have it, as well as several other relatives.
I have four sons, but we now have three granddaughters as well, three gorgeous little girls, and you know, I just couldn't bear them to go through this experience. And that's why this sort of research is so encouraging, because it's looking at those families who have no answers at the moment.
A scientific paper about the model is being published in the International Journal of Clinical Oncology today.
Rachel Carbonell. In Victoria's Grampians, the wild population of southern brush-tailed rock wallabies will increase by 20% today when 8 new wallabies are released into the bush. It will take the known number of these rare animals not in captivity to an estimated 48. As Michael Vincent reports, the release today is the result of a combined effort of wildlife officers and scientists from a number of states.
The southern brush-tailed rock wallaby has a nickname.
They're often referred to as the shadow because there's so few left in the wild out there and they're so elusive.
Brett McNamara works for the ACT Parks and Conservation Service.
So it's nice to think that the shadow is slowly making a triumphant return to the majestic Grampians.
The Tidbinbilla Nature Reserve has been breeding the rare wallabies, which were nearly wiped out by the fur trade early last century. Today, wildlife officers will be releasing 8 of the animals, with radio collars attached, into a special protected area of Victoria's Grampians.
And certainly it's a location that really suits the brush-tailed rock wallabies. They have particular requirements in terms of their habitat, large rocky cliffs, which they can obviously bound across quite merrily. So every precaution has been taken in terms of ensuring the survival of the species that has had foxes removed within that area.
Well, you're increasing the population by about 20%.
That's correct, yes. It doesn't seem like much when you talk about, you know, 40 in the wild and 8 being released, but it's all about taking these small but very, very important steps in terms of recovery of this particular species.
Are they breeding in the wild, do you know?
We've had a confirmation of one being bred in the wild, but it's early days yet in terms of being able to ensure that the species has been recovering on its own means, if you like. It's early days, but certainly through the monitoring program, the tracking that we have in place, we're pretty confident that brush-tailed rock wallabies will do very, very well.
It's the breeding program at Tidbinbilla Nature Reserve, with help from interstate colleagues at Parks Agencies Adelaide Zoo in Healesville, which Brett McNamara says has helped keep the species alive. He says the use of the cross-fostering technique has been critical.
Which is basically making use of surrogate mothers, surrogate mothers being similar wallaby species, whereby young joeys, brush-tailed rock wallabies, are removed from their mothers, placed with a surrogate mother, being a yellow-footed rock wallaby or a tamar wallaby. That then allows the brush-tailed rock wallaby mother to go back into cycle again, to have another joey, if you like. So through the cross-fostering techniques, this is how we've been able to build up the overall population. In fact, in 2012, we had 9 joeys born here at Tidbinbilla Nature Reserve, and 2011, it was our most successful year to date, with over 14 joeys born as a result of this cross-fostering technique.
Brett McNamara says there's now a total of 40 southern brush-tailed rock wallabies which remain in captivity. Wildlife officers have hopes for greater success with the breeding program and more mass releases in the future.
Michael Vincent reporting. To finance now, and Wall Street is closed because of approaching Hurricane Sandy. The New York Stock Exchange will also be closed tomorrow, making it the first consecutive closure for weather since 1888. In London, the FTSE finished the day down 12 points. The dollar is buying 103.3 US cents, 82.5 Japanese yen, 80.1 euro cents. I'm Tony Eastley. Thanks for your company, and that's AM for today.